Thank you all for coming. Tonight is the last in the series of Shiurim on Sefer Daniel. And tonight in particular, the capstone to the first six prakim. The six prakim that tell the stories of the life of Daniel, and particularly the stories of Daniel as he served in a succession of imperial courts. And we saw him at work with extraordinary hatzlacha, a word that comes up often, at different stages of Nebuchadnezzar's reign. In the last 2 weeks ago in Perek Hey, we saw Daniel at work in the much briefer reign of Belshazzar, where he was interpreting the vision, the writing on the wall that foretold the imminent demise of Belshazzar personally and of the Babylonian Empire. And now the last in these opening six prakim, the last of the six prakim that tell the stories, the events of the life of Daniel, the focus is now on the next empire. This is the beginning, Daryavesh HaMadi. This is Daryavesh of Madai. This is the rise of Paras or Madai, the Persian Empire, that overtakes and displaces the Babylonia. And over the course of this parak, we're going to watch the rise of Daniel to a position of great prominence, and the reaction of the people around him, a reaction that's going to drive the king, going to drive the people that surround Daniel, acting out of jealousy, back Daryavesh into a corner, and sort of maneuver Daryavesh into creating a decree that no one's allowed to pray. No one's allowed to ask anything of anyone, including of God. All your requests have to be directed towards Daryavesh, the emperor. Sounds like they're trying to build up the emperor. Their real intention was to catch Daniel, because they had looked around at Daniel, they were jealous of Daniel, they couldn't catch him on anything. So they have no choice but to create a rule that they know he's going to run afoul of. They know that Daniel davens. They're going to make daven illegal, and then they're going to catch him. And catch him they do, and they don't let Daryavesh crawl out. Daryavesh has a very soft spot in his heart for Daniel. Daniel is his vizier. Daniel is his right-hand man. They tell Daryavesh, you're not allowed to back out. That's the rule. Dase paras amadai. Echoes of what we'll hear a couple generations later in Megillas Esther, a couple years later, really, in Megillas Esther. Once the law has been given, you have no choice. You can't back out. This is the way it has to be. And he has no choice but to punish Daniel, as had been previously decided, by throwing him into a pit of ravenous lions, the Gov Arayos. He's there overnight. And in the morning, lo and behold, he's okay. And Daniel tells the emperor, Kadosh Baruch Hu sent the Malach. The Malach made sure that the lions were in harmony. And that's where things close. That's the overview of this final parak. The parak Vav, the parak of Daniel at the lion's den. But as always, as we dig deeper, there's so many nuances. And I'd like to take a look together and appreciate some of those nuances. And then hopefully have a chance to sort of step back and appreciate some of the larger themes of this parak and of this set of six prakim. The first change that becomes apparent when we shift from the Babylonian Empire and the Babylonian way of doing things to this new empire is things are much more methodical and things are much more formal. Ready in Pasuk Aleph, Daryavesh. He's 62 years old, and he decides, Shvar Kadam Daryavesh, Vayitav Ben Daryavesh in the translation, he's very interested in putting together bureaucracy. 120 Achashdar Panim, and above them, in Pasuk Gimel, there's a layer above them. The layer above them are three executive vice presidents, three Sarchin, of whom one is Daniel. Daniel and two others. And the psukim say that They're gonna give guidance. Umalkalola heavy nazik. That way the emperor will not suffer any nazik. The emperor will not suffer any damage. Things are methodical. Things are formalized. Daniel's position is formalized. He's never had this before. He was always, a helpful individual, but never had a formal role in Bava the way he does now in Madai, and a very, very significant role, and in a pattern that would recur again and again over the course of Jewish history. The court Jew attains great prominence, formalized prominence, and kinna and envy follow, and he is almost destroyed by that envy. And the Malvin is an interesting suggestion. He says he wonders whether Daryavish building more structure had to do with the opening pasuk is that Daryavish is 62 years old. Why is that so significant? So there may be several reasons. One of them may be that this explains that was part of the impetus. Daryavish was already early middle age, 62 years old, and he decided that he wanted to have more structure. He wasn't going on his own. And so he begins to build layers of bureaucracy and that perhaps is what the pasuk means in pasuk Gimel as well. And that way the king won't suffer any nezek. These three guiding figures, the king won't suffer any nezek on one level. What type of nezek are they helping him to avoid? What type of injury are they helping him to avoid? So perhaps professionally, politically, there's going to be a council, and there's going to be advisors, and that way they will reduce the number of bad moves politically, but it may also be personally. They were going to shoulder some of the burden. The average wouldn't be carrying all this on his own. He'll have a team to work with. So it'll reduce the personal drain. The psukim say that he has 120. The Malbim actually makes a fascinating suggestion. He says, when we get to Megillas Esther, we hear about 127 medinos. He's thinking, so it may be that the empire had grown, and there were another seven provinces. So there may be the 127 medinos. So 120 of them were overseen by these 120 achashdarpanim. And maybe the other seven were overseen by the seven, Sarai Paras Omadai, about whom we hear in Megillas Esther. Be that as it may, so the Daryavish, the emperor, he has this idea that he wants, the life will be simpler if he could create some bureaucracy. And as is often the case, bureaucracy has its ups and downs.
Why do you keep saying bureaucracy instead of like helpers?
It's helpers. He's definitely, bureaucracy is not necessarily a negative thing, but by bureaucracy I mean layers of structure. It's no longer as flat. Even the language, Ela Minhon, there are the 120, and above them, this is an org chart. There are 120, then above them are another three, and then above them is the emperors. He's definitely creating a more vertical structure. And then he's very taken by that. Daniel's already, as we said before, he's formalized for the first time as a member of the triumvirate, sort of the executive vice presidents that answer directly, that oversee all the 120 achashdarpanim, and then answer directly to the emperor. And then Daniel continues to rise. In Pasuk Dalet, Daniel is so successful that the king wants to move him up further. Malka Ashish Lakumase Al Komahusa. Forget about three. He will be the one and only executive vice president. In terms of figures in Tanakh that this may remind us of, for better and for worse, on the one hand Yosef, there's a negative figure also in Megillas Esther. Haman, exactly. The meteoric rise to power. Daniel's obviously a world of difference from Haman. Daniel does not seek to take the opportunity to amass power and to impose himself on others. What unfortunately happens is instead there's a transmutative jealousy. And that's what happens in Pasuk Hei. The Sarchaya and the Achashdarpanai, the other two Sirachim who were passed over, as well as the 120 Achashdarpanim, who they're not necessarily losing by Daniel moving up, they're all jealous. And they're all trying to figure out what they're going to do. And the pasuk says they couldn't find anything, and they couldn't find anything. They couldn't find an excuse. Mitzad Malchusa, on the political side, they couldn't find any. They couldn't point to any bad judgment or any corruption in Daniel's professional life. They couldn't find any hashchasa, which Malm suggests means that they even tried digging into his personal life. Not only was he clean professionally, but he was a law-abiding citizen person as well. They couldn't catch him on anything. Kol shlu, kol shechisa, they couldn't even catch anything personal. So that's why they say, well, we're going to have to create something. We know that he's religious, and that's how we're going to get him. Now, the approach that they take is somewhat strange. And they come to the emperor, and they say to him in Pasuk Ches, you know, we all had this idea that we should make requests illegal. No one's allowed to make a request of anyone. They're going to make an Isser. So you're going to make an Isser. No one's allowed to make a request of anyone. Of call it law of the Anash. Can't make any request of God nor of man for 30 days. So he says, we all decide this is a great idea. Anyone who does is going to be thrown to the Gov Arayos. Isn't that a great idea? Ka'an and Pasuk Tes. Here we want you to, put sign the dotted line. Stamp this into law, and he does. And Daniel knows that that's the case in Pasuk Yidav. Daniel Kediyada, he knows that this is the law, and he moves on with his davening, with the windows open, facing Yerushalayim. And the whole thing is strange. What type of bizarre rule? How they convince clearly a very astute emperor? Well, you can't ask anyone for anything. It's sillier than anything that Achashverosh agreed to, and there's nothing silly about Dayavish. What type of bizarre? He outlawed religion. He wanted to be. Did he think that he was God? We have come across emperors who did think they were God. We don't see any evidence of Dayavish feeling that way. What's he angling for? Why? We know what their angle is, but why is he agreeing to this? And then there's another question, which is Daniel in Pasuk Yud Aleph. No, the Pasuk stresses Daniel knows about this and proceeds to nonchalantly violate it, to daven with the windows wide open. Kavan psichen lebalisei neged Yerushalayim. The windows are wide open on the upper floor facing Yerushalayim. A Pasuk which the Gemara quotes as one of the sources for the idea of davening facing Yerushalayim. And the Pasuk says Zimnin Pasuk Biyoma. Three times every day, Hu Baruch HaBechoi, he's bowing down on his knees, Matzle Umode Kadam Elokei, Davin Takarish Baruch Hu, Bin Mode Takarish Baruch Hu, there's Tefillah, and there's Hodaya, he's davening the way he always davens, three times a day, to meet him, consider him facing Yerushalayim, with all the dinim. This is sort of, it almost seems like the beginning of the more formalized type of davening that Ezra would soon put into place, as the Rambam records. He knows that's a capital crime. Now we started the stories of Daniel with him being ready to Moser Nefesh, for what's right. He's ready to. He was from the get go. He's going to see how he can avoid eating treifa food. That was our introduction to Daniel. But you'll remember there that. That he may have been worried, it may have been, as we discussed at the time, the opening shiur, it may pass Baga Melech, he may have been concerned that there was something idolatrous about it. He may also have been concerned that they were trying to, there was an attempt to, like almost like a Shas Hashmad, to disconnect those Jewish boys from their religion. And you'll also remember that Daniel approached the situation with extraordinary finesse. He didn't just say, I don't care about this, I'm doing my thing. He had a conversation. He had a delicate conversation with the minister, and then he talks to the Meltzer, and he handled it. He said, let's try like this. Give me 10 days. Let's see how it goes. He handled it with a lot of finesse and a lot of sophistication. And here he just davens. It doesn't seem like Yaron Vayavar. Tefillah is not Yaron Vayavar. It doesn't seem like the Shas Hashvad necessarily. He's in a different position. He's the meeting. Maybe he thought he'd get away with it. He's the top dog.
Or maybe he had to. In other words, that he didn't have to. That hiding would have been the wrong thing to do in that position.
Because then they'll catch him. He's open about it. Interesting. Interesting. It does seem like he thinks if he's going to be open about it. So the Malbim has a suggestion, sort of puts these two pieces together like puzzle pieces, trying to understand what Dayavish's angle on this was and what Daniel's angle was. See, he suggests, he thinks that the key is the 30 days. It seems like a little detail. He says that's actually key here. They didn't say that forever after, no one can make any requests of any man or of any deity, only of Dayavish. It's 30 days. 30 days. And we just heard about Dayavish ascending to his ring. So what the Rambam suggests is that the way they sold it, the real angle was they want to catch Daniel. But the way they sold it to Dayavish is, let's create sort of like the royal honeymoon, like talk about the presidential honeymoon. Like, we're just getting started, so let's get things started. We have the opportunity to sort of build the people's minds that you're the man to come to. That you're a man of great power, and you're a man of great capacity, and you're a man of great compassion. And that for 30 days, not forever after, but for 30 days, everything goes to the emperor. He's capable of handling everything, and he wants to take care of all of his subjects. It'll be a good honeymoon. It'll set the right tone. That's what they said to Dayavish. And if you read the psukim, not only does it explain why it was a 30-day suggestion, but the language that's used is that this will be Mekayim Yer Malchus. Here in Pasuk Ches, they told him, L'kayma kiyam malka, or takafa isa. So there are different ways of translating that. So here's the translation that the translation you have in front of you is L'hakim chok. L'kayma kiyam malka is to establish a new rule and to create an isa. The Rambam suggests, no, L'kayma kiyam malka means to give kiyum, to give sturdiness, to establish your malchus, to establish your reign. Let's put this into place. Let's put into place a temporary Easter that will get people into the framework, into the mentality of you go to the king. He has the capacity, he has the compassion, he's your man. So the Dayavish thought, that's okay, it's interesting. If you all feel that that's the way to go, I'll take your advice. And that may also explain why Daniel didn't... Daniel didn't think that he was doing anything wrong, because he wasn't sort of reaching out to HaKadosh Baruch with some specific request that could instead have gone to the king. He was doing his daily davening. Moda HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Mispal HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So as you said, he wasn't scared. He didn't think he was doing anything wrong. Of course, you know, what was right and wrong was really irrelevant to the people who were trying to snag him. It's interesting, because where this then takes us is something that actually has a remarkably contemporary ring. Because in the back and forth, they come in Pasuk Yudbeis, there's this crowd is just waiting to catch Daniel. And you know, within a couple of hours, Shachar's Mincha Maariv, whichever it was, he's snagged. They come to the king and said, hey, you made this law, and now Daniel violated it, and he has to be thrown to the Gov Arayos. But they don't mention Daniel right away. First they say, well, someone violated. And the language, by the way, they use is, it's a different verb. When Daniel is davening, as we saw before, the verbs were matzle u'mode. He's mispalel, and he's being mode. Ongoing tefillah and thanks. The verb that they use is kol nashi yiv'e. Any person who makes a request, making a specific request, and Dayavish says, absolutely, yeah, that's the rule that we had made. They said, well, that's Daniel. Daniel is ignoring you. Lo sam alach malka te'ein. He's ignoring your rule. He's ignoring the Iser that you made. And again, the verb that they use in Pasuk Yudal also is ba'e bu'usei. Three times a day, he is making specific requests. So they're fudging things a little bit because they want to get him in trouble. And then there's this sort of back and forth. By Pasuk Yud Zayin, the emperor is tossing Daniel to his great dismay into the Gov Arayos. But over the course of Psukim Tezvav and Tezayin, there's a back and forth. In Pasuk Tezav, the king says, well, he doesn't want to do it to Daniel. He loves Daniel. And he's trying to save him. Interesting language. Al Daniel, some Baal Sheiz will say. He's trying to figure out how can he save him. And the other people in Pasuk Zayin said, no, you can't do that. Da Malka, ki dasal ma'adai paras. The law, the rule of the Persian Empire, kol asar kiam di malka yahakem, lo lahashnaya. Once the king puts a law into place, it cannot be changed. English knows. It can't be changed. So what's the back? Yeah. Sure. Yeah, that's an interesting point. It's an interesting point. If and when we start to learn Megillas Esther, we'll see that that's actually part of the dynamic and part of the political dynamic of Megillas Esther is that question of is the emperor absolute or is he what we might call a constitutional monarch, which is what seems to be at play here too. You're the emperor, you have a lot of power, but there are also traditions that you're even the emperor is bound by them. Even the emperor has to work within a constitution of sorts. You also have, he does have limits, he does have limits on his power. Now the Malbim suggests, given what we were talking about before, so the nuance of the reason why Dayanovich had agreed is because it was a specific, more of a targeted prohibition that requests would be made to the emperor for a period of time in order to build a certain acceptance of the emperor. And Daniel, as far as he was concerned, wasn't doing anything wrong. So what the Malbim suggests is that the back and forth in Psukim Tezvav and Tezayin is that the emperor is saying, he was trying to save, it wasn't breaking in anywhere. Obviously this was a legal or a political back and forth. Daniel hasn't been thrown into the lions yet. Obviously the king was trying to find a legal recourse. And they're saying, you can't do it. You can't change this. What was he trying to do? The Malbim suggests that, again, it has a remarkably contemporary ring to it. The Malbim suggests that it's a question of interpretation. The emperor says, what Daniel, the sort of prayer that Daniel was doing, had nothing to do with the purpose of the legislation. So we're going to have to interpret legislation based on the rationale. And the language that the pasuk uses in Tezayin, they say no, lo lahashnayeh, you cannot change. I mean, they're saying you gotta read the text literally. Whatever it says, you can't build in, you can't interpret based on rationale. Just read the text, straight reading of the text. Read the text. We do this wrong. You're telling me you have your shtickle Torah that what he was doing wasn't running afoul of the rationale of the law. That's irrelevant. Legislation is what it is. And not only can't you void the legislation, you also can't start post facto reinterpreting. It is what it is, and that's the law, and he broke the law, and they're really, as you're saying, he is a limited monarch in this way. He's thrown to the lions, he's thrown to the Govarayos, and in the
Can I just ask any please? Significance to the lions that seems distinct? Maybe that was culturally common?
That would have been their suggestion. It's the Achashdarpun that made that suggestion. Yes, I'm not sure historically whether, I would be curious to know, historically was this common, or was this somehow supposed to, was there something symbolic about it? If the goal of the legislation was to reinforce the power of the monarch, then maybe the lion was symbolic of the power of the monarch? I'm not sure. I'm not sure if lion as the king of the forest was a Persian concept also or not. But if it was, so then maybe that's part of what's going on.
If it was related to the gladiator model.
Oh, I don't know. Interesting. Interesting. Well, precursor. Like this is several centuries before. Maybe. And here it seems like it was a given. This wasn't sport. This wasn't sport. There was no question of what was
sure.
Happened. As a matter of fact, in Pasuk Yud-Ches, they seal it closed with an enormous stone, and it's counter-sealed by both the king and the his sarim. Neither one trusts the other. They don't trust the king to either maybe throw some food to these hungry lions, or maybe lower down the ladder and pull Daniel out, and he doesn't trust them to not make some sort of mischief. So each one seals the closed, and then the pasuk attests that the king spends a sleepless night. He's fasting, he can barely sleep, and he's sick with worry what's going to happen with Daniel. He comes in the morning, and the king himself, fascinatingly, wonders. The king doesn't assume Daniel's dead. The king had said to Daniel, the pasuk Yud-Zayin, the God who you daven to, he should help you. And indeed, in pasuk Chaf Aleph, he comes, he calls, and then he calls louder. He says, Daniel, he says, Aved Elokach Haya. Evan, you're a servant of the living God. Did God save you? Fascinating. The degree of emunah that Daniel Avishai is remarkable. I mean, Daniel was thrown hours ago with hungry lions. Nothing to talk about. Daniel Avishai is open to the fact there may have been a miracle, and indeed there is. Daniel responds, he says, Roshom sent to Malach, closed, as it were, the mouths of the lions, it didn't hurt me, and he says, I did well. He said, that's because I didn't do anything wrong, and I didn't do anything wrong to you either. In Pasuk Chav Gimel, almost a precursor to an expression of the idea of Dimachus Adina. I didn't do any wrong by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I haven't done anything wrong by you. I follow the rules. I'm going back to how the Baal Ma'amar understood. I didn't even break this rule. I've been a law-abiding citizen. I've been a law-abiding citizen from Klape Rebbe Hashem, law-abiding citizen Klape the Persian Empire. And then the psukim end with those who try to do Daniel in are thrown to lions, and the lions are clearly, it's not the lions weren't hungry. The pasuk says very visual, very vivid, and graphic. They don't even make it to the floor. The lions grab these people out of the air. And then the parak ends, the section of Daniel ends with a public letter. We've had several public letters over the course of Sefer Daniel. A public letter that Elokei Daniel is real. And he's the one who runs the world, and we should all respect that. And the parak ends with Daniel was matzliach over the course of the reign of Daryavish, and we hear for one clause, and the reign of Koresh HaParsi. No stories about what happens during the reign of Koresh HaParsi, but Daniel was there, and he was matzliach. So stepping back is where we've been. So to take the sum of, as we've seen, this is, we open by saying that this is, Sefer Daniel is not, in particular the first half of the Sefer, is neither the Nevi'im who are talking about, you know, how to avoid, how to avert a Churban, nor the Sefer Eicha bemoaning the Churban that has happened, but this is watching, now that Churban has come, now that we're in Galus, how do we operate successfully in Galus? And we've seen, just thinking where we've been, and think about the themes that we've seen. We saw that he was careful about Kashrus, he was careful to avoid Avodah Zarah. We saw the value of tzedakah. We've seen Daniel speaking truth to power repeatedly. And we've seen Daniel with sort of an interesting blend of midos, extraordinary confidence, and also being able to take setbacks in stride in remarkable fashion, both of which really stem from a very powerful emunah. An emunah which he was building in the people and the emperors around him. And a mitzvah that we've seen repeatedly throughout these prakim, and the mitzvah that climaxes these prakim, and that captures this emunah bitachon, of course, is the mitzvah of tefillah. And again, and it climaxes here, not only this is the central theme here, the driver of the whole drama centers around Daniel's tefillah, but the descriptions, the kavim psichim, the descriptions of davening three times a day, the descriptions of the open window facing Yerushalayim. And that, to close, that Kavim Psichim, Rabbi Eliyahu Kronosberg pointed to many years ago, it's fascinating that when the Rambam opens the halachas of tefillah, he includes that detail as part of the basic definition of tefillah. Facing Yerushalayim isn't just one of the 1,001 details of Pirtei Hilchos tefillah, it's part of the definition of what it means to daven. Jews, he says, Rambam says, Jews throughout the ages have always davened towards Yerushalayim. It captures, among other things, the striving for Geula and the ongoing connection to Yerushalayim, even in Galus. And that's how this parak and this whole section ends, with a reference to Koresh. We saw parak Alpha end with a reference to Koresh. It seemed out of place at the time. He said that Daniel is going to span the whole period of Galus. And once again, Koresh is the later emperor of the Persian Empire who will send the Jews back to Yerushalayim, will send give the Jews the capacity to build Beis HaMikdash. So the Ryan Sefer Daniel are taking pains to connect this. He's the man who shows us how to live successfully in Galus all the way until the end of Galus with the Bayis Sheni. And look at the second half of Sefer Daniel with a vision of gain all the way till the end of Galus with a Sefer that closes with Tchias HaMeisim and Gula Shleim and may we be Zocha to see it in Mirtz Hashem sooner in our times. Thank you so much.